The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a fascinating case to say a judge has hired private counsel to defend the judge's ability to decide a case, and the prosecutor and the defendant are on the same side against the judge. I mean, there's all kinds of fascinating aspects here.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 4th, 2020. It was a big week for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, handing down opinions in not one but two cases that had gone to the full court on former presidential White House advisors. The case of Don McGahn, former White House counsel, was decided by a panel of the court, having been kicked back to that panel by the full court earlier in the summer. The case of Michael Flynn was decided by the full court, reversing a panel that had earlier ordered a lower court judge to throw the criminal case out. It's a dizzying series of events involving a complex bunch of cases, but we have the perfect group here to talk us all through it. Scott Anderson, who clerked on the D.C. Circuit and is a Lawfare senior editor and Brookings scholar, joined me in the virtual jungle studio, as did Jonathan David Schaub, who is newly a professor at the UK Rosenberg College of Law. And that's UK is University of Kentucky, not United Kingdom. We talked about the Flynn case. We talked about the McGahn case. We talked about the en banc court versus the panels that it has generated. And we talked about where these cases are going next. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 4th, a busy week at the D.C. Circuit. All right, Jonathan Schaub, get us started. It was a big week for the D.C. Circuit. Perhaps the case that got the most attention was the latest decision in the subpoena case involving former White House counsel Don McGahn. What did the court do, and how big a deal is it in your view?
It's a pretty interesting week. Monday was Judge Griffith's last day as a judge. He's not taking senior status. So presumably the court knew it had to get those opinions out before he left the bench. The Supreme Court recently said, you know, if a judge is not on service anymore, he can't participate. So there seemed to be some time pressure, particularly in the McGahn case. And a little background to understand kind of how we got here. The district court held that there was jurisdiction, that McGahn had to testify despite his claim of absolute immunity. And then the first panel, when it went up to the D.C. Circuit, an opinion written by Judge Griffith held that the federal courts did not have jurisdiction over suits filed by the House to enforce their subpoenas. So they ordered the case dismissed, essentially eliminated any opportunity for Congress to ever go to the courts to try to enforce their subpoenas. That case was taken en banc. And in the beginning of August, the en banc court, 7-2 vote, with the two dissenting judges being Judge Griffith and Judge Henderson, who formed the majority on the panel, they reversed that decision and said, no, the federal courts do have jurisdiction. Part of that opinion emphasized sort of the importance of having judicial review for the subpoenas. And they kicked it back to the panel, the same panel, to adjudicate the remaining issues. it would note two of the judges, Judge Katsas and Judge Rao, recused themselves from the en banc, so they did not participate. But still, they couldn't have swung either way. It was 7-2 vote. So back to the panel. There's a few remaining sort of preliminary issues in the case, and one of them, the government has argued that the House doesn't have a cause of action to bring suit. And on Monday, in Judge Griffith's opinion, again, he was joined by Judge Henderson, and again, Judge Rogers dissented. He ruled that the House lacked a cause of action. It's a pretty short opinion. He neglects to include a lot of history, and it's an argument that DOJ has been making for a long time. It's not new to this administration, but Judge Bates in 2007 and Judge Jackson in 2012 or 13, the Fast and Furious case, both of them have rejected this argument pretty persuasively, I thought, and Judge Griffith didn't really deal with any of it. So he basically said there's a statute that gives the Senate a cause of action. There's no such statute for the House. And we're not going to exercise these traditional powers of equity that courts have, and the case has to be dismissed.
So we will return to the McGahn case momentarily for a kind of deeper examination of a bunch of those points. But before we do, McGahn was not the only former White House official to get a ruling from the D.C. Circuit this week or to have to deal with the en banc court. General Flynn, the long-running criminal case of whose was previously ordered dismissed by the Justice Department and hung up in the courts, also got an en banc ruling this week, also overturning a panel. Scott, bring us up to speed on the D.C. Circuit machinations in the Flynn case.
Well, sure. Just to catch everyone up and remind us where the Flynn case was before this decision came down, Flynn, of course, pled guilty to making false statements to the FBI several years ago at this point, actually cooperated with the government for a period as part of that plea, although there's been some grumbling about how cooperative in the later phases that he was, and was awaiting sentencing on that plea, in part because of a decision by the trial judge, Judge Sullivan, to withhold sentencing or hold off on sentencing until his cooperation with the government was complete, when the Justice Department kind of reversed track, essentially said, we actually don't think we have adequate evidence to prosecute General Flynn, and therefore we are going to motion to dismiss this prosecution against him. Once the Justice Department filed this motion, the opposing counsel, the counsel for General Flynn, basically withdrew the motions that they had had in place contesting the plea agreement, trying to withdraw that plea agreement, and said, we concur with the government. We should dismiss this case. We consent to their dismissal. Not only that, the government was seeking to dismiss it with prejudice, essentially establishing that General Flynn could not be prosecuted again for these same crimes or same allegations. The judge, Judge Sullivan, had not yet granted this motion, had appointed an amicus to come in and brief kind of the other side to say, well, are there reasons why I should be issuing an order to show cause, in particular as to why Flynn should not be faced perjury charges specifically for actually having pled guilty and falsely said that, in fact, I had lied before and was guilty of that offense. And so there was an ongoing debate that the judge in the trial level was trying to hold a hearing on to say, all right, I have an amicus bringing in and briefing these issues. Should I consider, what proceedings should I do to weigh in as to whether to rule on the government's motion to dismiss? General Flynn's counsel in this case stepped in and said, we are actually not going to wait for the resolution of this matter by the district court. We are going to step in and instead request that the circuit court step in and issue a mandamus, an extraordinary type of remedy that would essentially compel the district court to act in a certain way, to try and compel the district court to grant the motion to dismiss. A three-judge panel headed by Judge Rao and joined by Judge Henderson in the majority, the two of them, Judge Rao wrote the majority opinion, essentially said that yes, in fact, the judge should be compelled under mandamus to grant this motion to dismiss, in part because it is such a fundamental aspect of the federal government's prosecutorial discretion to be able to drop these sorts of charges. But we had a pretty surprisingly and uncharacteristically critical dissent by Judge Wilkins, who's usually, frankly, fairly mild-mannered and makes an effort, sometimes in unconventional ways, to find common ground. In this case, he wrote a pretty strident dissent accusing the majority of the panel of essentially overstepping the bounds of the mandamus authority and acting outside of their own authority. At this point, there is a motion to bring it en banc. And evidently, we learned in this opinion, I don't believe this was reported previously, that actually one of the judges had sua sponte suggested raising the issue en banc, which is a power of the judges have in the D.C. Circuit, and brought up the issue, vacating the panel opinion and eventually issuing this most recent opinion. In this opinion, we see the majority of the court, 8 judges, voting essentially to say we are reversing the opinion of the panel opinion. We find that the remedy of mandamus is extraordinary enough that it shouldn't be granted in a case where there are still other remedies available, such as a more conventional appeal in this case, if and when Judge Sullivan rules on the motion to dismiss, and that the panel opinion essentially overstepped its bounds. And not only that, we actually saw the court write it in what's called a per curiam, meaning it's speaking on behalf of the court itself, which is often a sort of subtle or not so subtle hint that the court is fairly united on this point. And can, I think, in this case be taken as being a fairly critical take on the panel opinion written by Judge Rao and joined by Judge Henderson. Both Rao and Henderson both dissented from the per curiam opinion, Rao kind of reiterating her arguments regarding the appropriateness of mandamus from the panel opinion, and Judge Henderson stepping in and actually arguing that the court should have granted a separate motion to reassign the matter to a different trial judge, essentially saying that she found that the trial judge, Judge Sullivan, had primarily through the proceedings before his court actually indicated a sort of bias against General Flynn, something that the majority of the court had greeted very skeptically and had pointed out that it's a very, very high bar to reassign a judge. Based on this, the matter is going to go back to where it started, back in the court of Judge Sullivan, who's now going to be in a position to hold whatever proceedings he thinks are appropriate and then ultimately rule on the government's motion to dismiss.
All right, so a huge amount on the table there, and let's take it in order. Let's start with McGann. First of all, I want, just for listeners who do not understand this distinction, because this distinction is critical to the way this case has developed so far in the D.C. Circuit. Jonathan, what is the difference between a finding that somebody lacks standing, which is what the panel did the first time around and the en banc court reversed, and a finding that there is no cause of action for the suit? To a layman, those seem like awfully similar things, but they're producing now two entirely different panel opinions and presumably two entirely different trips to the en banc court. So walk us through that distinction for those who do not understand it.
Yeah, it's one that trips up, you know, people in law school and even the courts, or especially when you look at older cases, they're not as clear about what they're talking about. But the first issue was standing, and that's an aspect of jurisdiction under the Constitution. So the Constitution gives federal courts jurisdiction to hear, you know, particular cases. And one requirement is that anybody who is bringing suit has to have standing under the Constitution, which means they have to have a sufficient injury that a federal court can recognize and redress the injury in a lawsuit. So in the first set of cases that went up, Judge Griffith found that the House's injury, which the House's injury is that McGann has not complied with their subpoena, which is a pretty common injury for a private party. But he said, well, this is a dispute between the branches, and the House is not injured in a way that the Constitution recognizes that would provide jurisdiction for the federal courts to hear the case. So essentially, no federal court under the Constitution can ever hear this, you know, no matter what laws are passed or what Congress does, the Constitution doesn't allow courts to hear it. So the en banc reversed that and said, no, this is a pretty standard injury, a failure to comply with a subpoena. And the fact that this is the House against a former executive branch official doesn't alter that. There is jurisdiction under the Constitution. So then it goes back. And the question of the cause of action is what statute the individual is suing under. And Congress passes laws that say, you know, a litigant may bring this case in court. And the Supreme Court recently, over the last, probably 30 years, has been a little more cautious about ensuring that the person bringing suit has a statute that says you can go into federal court, because Congress doesn't have to allow everybody that the Constitution allows to go to court. They don't have to pass statutes to allow them all. So there's the constitutional sort of minimum of what courts can do. And then there also has to be, you know, Congress blessing the fact that that suit is in court. And here, the allegation and the arguments that, that Griffith accepted were, you know, Congress has passed a law that says the Senate may go to court to enforce its subpoenas. They haven't done that with the House. And there has to be this express statute giving it, giving the House the right to sue for there to be a cause of action. And we can talk about sort of the validity of that and what, there's a lot of history kind of behind that, but that's the basic distinction here, is that there is no statute that says specifically the House can sue the executive branch in court. And for Griffith, that was enough to say, we're going to have to dismiss this case because there's no cause of action, no congressional approved way to come to court for this.
So, Scott, my impression is that this issue is a little bit closer in the en banc court, a little bit less predictable than maybe the standing question was. Do you agree with that? Or do you think this is as DOA when it assuming it goes en banc again, as the last round was?
You know, it's a good question, and I'm not 100% sure. Certainly, it's notable that the last time this matter went en banc, the en banc court decided not to reach this issue. They actually did so in a way that was criticized by Judge Griffith and Judge Henderson in their dissents. In their dissents for the en banc opinion, they basically said, this is how we're going to rule on the cause of action issue. So if you remand to us, you're just wasting your time and everyone's time in doing so. We might as well resolve it now as a court. And the court elected not to. And it's quite possible that's because there wasn't enough unity, or at least enough certainty in the unity about their views on that matter, that they could reach the same outcome. Again, that prior opinion was a 7-2 ruling, which is pretty strong consensus around that 7-member majority around a single opinion authored by Judge Rogers. So they may have wanted to maintain that unity and so held off on resolving the cause of action question so that they could maintain that unanimity and just save it for later once the panel opinion comes through. You know, it's also worth noting that Judge Griffith, of course, is not going to be on the court in this next en banc. They'll have a new member, presumably, who will be in a position to kind of weigh in, and it may change how the court views these sorts of issues, may bring new arguments to the fore, may at least vote differently. Although, presumably, Judge Katsas and Judge Rao will still be recusing themselves. That said, I'm also not so sure. You know, you have saw, again, a 7-member majority in the opinion authored by Judge Rogers, the last en banc court, really harping in on the importance of these sorts of subpoenas in the enforcement investigation measures that Congress can undertake as part of its legislative authority, or as kind of an adjunct to its legislative authority. And that sort of importance, the real emphasis on there being a real injury there, on being some sort of a capacity that is constitutionally recognized and cognizable, in my mind, weighs in favor of some of the arguments that Judge Rogers brought to bear in her dissent from this panel opinion, which is emphasizing the fact that really we should be reading an implied cause of action from Article 1 in giving these authorities to Congress and the institutions of Congress, meaning the individual houses, and from them delegated down to the committees, as is the case here, to pursue these sorts of actions and actually have them have a legal effect, be enforceable, essentially. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit more pushback, a little more caveating. Maybe we'll see some more concurrences. Maybe we'll see some one or two people split off into a dissent, particularly because, you know, they'll be trying to consider this matter in light of the Supreme Court, which has been more critical, as Jonathan has described, of a lot of this idea that there are all these implied causes of actions in the Constitution. They've really been cutting that off in a variety of areas over the last 50 years, really, of jurisprudence and trimming down and kind of freezing that as is in the law. I suspect that, though, that in the end, this panel opinion is not going to stand because of the strength of that seven-member opinion authored by Judge Rogers in the last en banc court and the kind of underlying principles that seem to be motivating it. It's also possible, I suppose, I don't believe we've seen a formal announcement as to whether this will be brought en banc. It might have come out and I missed the last few days. It's also possible they'll try and take it directly to the Supreme Court, although I also find that unlikely because I think that parties in this are not likely to see the Supreme Court of being more amenable to this than the en banc court. So I think we'll probably go en banc. I suspect you'll get it reversed, and then we'll just have to see kind of how that plays out may weigh into how the parties move it forward from there. Does that sound right to you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's a much thornier issue, I think, in many ways, because there's not really a clear answer about how we deal with these constitutional claims that we recognize there's an injury, and yet there's no specific statutory cause of action. I have a piece up on Lawfare today about this issue, and my argument, and I think it doesn't come out in the opinions, in my view, because they must have just been kind of rushing and hurrying, but there's all kinds of history of courts redressing constitutional injuries using their sort of inherent power of equity. And that is essentially implying that there is a right to bring suit in order to fix the injury. And the cases where the Supreme Court has said, don't do that, have typically been either statutory cases where someone's alleging wants to sue under a statute that doesn't give them the express right to do so, or where they're suing for a constitutional violation but seeking damages. And the court has essentially closed that off as another way, as a way to imply constitutional tort claims where you're going to get damages from an officer. But they haven't done so with this kind of equitable suit, where you're just asking the court to order someone to testify or someone to remedy a constitutional injury. And, you know, Judge Griffith doesn't really deal with that or answer why, you know, that shouldn't be the same here. And the statutory claim is the thornier one, I think. And I think that's where, you know, going from what Scott said, you might see some disagreement or some judges peel off and try to figure out what to do because there is this express statute for the Senate and not one for the House. So how do we interpret that? What does that mean? The two district judges I mentioned before who dealt with this issue, they sort of showed why those statutes were enacted. One of them was really enacted when they created the Senate Legal Council. And so it's sort of viewing it as a whole. It's just really laying out the responsibilities of the Senate Council. And there's a statement that says this is not meant to imply that Congress can't bring suit. So it's pretty clear from the history that Congress wasn't trying to cut off its own ability to bring suit or to cut off the House's ability. But, you know, you still have to kind of reckon with the fact that there is a statute for the Senate and not for the House. And I think that will require a little more analysis from the en banc court. But I think you ultimately probably have the same split, that everybody who voted for there to be jurisdiction, to say there's jurisdiction but there's not a cause of action, is sort of splitting the baby in a way that doesn't make any sense. And I think that the emphasis in that opinion on, you know, that you need to have judicial enforcement, this is really important for congressional oversight. If they can't do this, they're going to have to go send the sergeant of arms with guns blazing to arrest the former White House counsel. And those same kind of considerations will lead them all to find that there is an implied cause of action under the Constitution and the Declaratory Judgment Act. And, you know, this court should hear on the merits. You know, whether we actually get to a merits decision, there's another question about statutory jurisdiction. That's a whole nother question that Griffith doesn't answer. In this opinion, Rogers' dissent sort of says he answers it, but he doesn't really. And then, you know, there's the merits of his absolute immunity claim. There's an election coming up. The House's subpoena will expire at the end of this session. So whether we actually get any resolution of this case is highly questionable in my mind. But I do think we'll see the en banc reverse this decision and make it clear that either House of Congress can sue to enforce its subpoenas.
All right, let's talk about General Flynn. So, Scott, I interpreted the brevity of the 8-member majority's decision, as well as the sort of tone, which really made the case seem like an easy one, as a pretty harsh rebuke to the panel. The panel had written a fairly extensive discussion, and as you point out in dissent, Judge Henderson actually goes farther than the panel did. But the majority treats the matter as an easy case that is controlled by basically the entire history of the judiciary. That is, for them, it is as simple as you can't mandamus the judge before he's done anything. And asking for amicus brief doesn't count as doing anything. And you got to wait until he rules. Is this as much a slap in the face to the panel as it reads to me?
I really think it is. You can get it, as you noted, both from the tone of the written opinion. We don't know who wrote it because it was submitted per curiam, but you can tell the author is pretty straightforward, but detailed in breaking down a lot of the arguments that Judge Rao brought to the fore in the panel opinion on a variety of fronts, particularly noting that the suggestion that there's no alternative remedy seems pretty ridiculous here. Because again, there is, of course, a remedy, at which point the motion is issued. They could wait for Judge Sullivan to rule on the motion to dismiss. If he denies it, they could wait for sentencing, then appeal from there on their argument that that's an error. There are other motions and other practices they can pursue. And in the end, this is supposed to be an extraordinary step, stepping in and actually interfering with a trial court's conduct of a matter like this without, again, them having actually ruled on a matter, appointing an amicus, as you noted, really is, it's a bit of a stretch to say that's actually ruling, is pretty exceptional. And it's kind of similar in that ways to the McGann en banc opinion, which again, being a 7-2 opinion, that because this was 8-2, because Judge Rao did not kind of recuse herself of this matter, obviously, because she was the panel author. In that case, we saw Judge Rogers, who is the dissenter in the McGann panel opinion, actually write the opinion, kind of clearly signaling that she had the strength and the confidence of the majority of the court on that issue. I think this per curiam takes an even step further than that, to say that we are so unanimous, no one of us needs to take authorship of this opinion. We are all united in thinking that essentially this is wrongheaded. And that should be a little bit concerning to some respects, or to some certain judges who are trying to build coalitions, build relationships with other judges, find ways to appeal to them. For a relatively new judge like Judge Rao, this could be taken as a signal to say, all right, I'm not doing a very good job of persuading my peers in the broader court, even if I get lucky to be put on a panel with Judge Henderson, who happens to agree with me and is frankly kind of a pushover on a bit of some of these issues. But you know, that also doesn't necessarily appear to be Judge Rao's goal here. She has really, in a number of opinions across the board that are particularly partisan, have a partisan tinge to them and get a lot of partisan attention, she really has adopted fairly unorthodox views in a way that leans towards the administration that appointed her. You can take guesses as to what the motivation for that is. Here, Judge Griffith actually files a super brief 2-page concurrence in this Flynn opinion, where he says essentially, this isn't a partisan thing. It just looks like a partisan thing, but it's really not. We're talking about court powers here. But it's just notable that other than Judge Griffith, who joined the majority and concurred with them here, that you do have this kind of partisan split, and that Judge Rao and Judge Henderson are doing something that, not just to the eyes of the other judges on the court, but also to a lot of commentators, seems pretty exceptional and out of line with how the court has approached these issues in the past. I'll also note there, the one thing that's really exceptional that jumped out to me, for example, is Judge Henderson jumping in with a dissent specifically aiming at this motion to get Judge Sullivan reassigned from the case, which is a pretty extraordinary step, and that the court dealt with very summarily, and that the panel opinion, actually, if I recall correctly, didn't even really reach that issue or say that that was appropriate either. Maharishi jumps in support of it, and a lot of the incidents she states are rulings that he's issued in this case, how he's managed the lower case, and statements issued in one particular hearing relating to what at the time was a crime that General Flynn had pled guilty to and was clearly premised on the assumption that he was in fact guilty as he claimed at the time, although he later tried to withdraw that guilty plea. So, and in that case, Judge Henderson said the last step that Judge Sullivan did that really crossed the line here was seeking to bring this matter en banc, which seems particularly ridiculous, or waiting for the matter, I guess, to go en banc instead of relying on the panel opinion. Again, that's a procedural part of the court. That's how the majority of the judges approach this matter. They basically say that explicitly, saying this is the judge managing his courtroom. That's not something we're supposed to look at in evaluating whether he's biased. And yet Judge Henderson isn't persuaded by that for reasons that are a little unclear.
To be fair to Judge Henderson on that point, I do think there's a little bit more to say, not on the general issue of Judge Sullivan's bias, which I think is pretty frivolous, but on the specific issue of his asking the full court to look at it. So this was an issue on which the Solicitor General's office urged this position, and their view was that while they had not joined previously calls for his replacement, the fact that he effectively became a litigant by moving the court for en banc review, whereas previously he had merely been a kind of passive, not even quite a party, right, but a sort of passive participant in that the other side had asked for extraordinary relief and he had briefed the question of his own handling of the matter. Here, he was becoming an actual litigant against one of the parties before his court in an environment in which it was not actually clear that he had standing to do that because, of course, he is not a party to the case. And so the government argued that maybe at this point he has taken a sufficiently adverse position relative to one of the parties that removal is a plausible remedy. I also think this is why it was significant that one of the judges on the court moved sua sponte for the court to consider the matter en banc, because it's not clear that it would have jurisdiction to under Sullivan's request. And so I think there was a little bit more to that component of it than you apparently do. But that said, I agree with you that it's ultimately a pretty weak argument and one that did not get the support of any of the other of the judges. Jonathan, I'm curious for your sense of how much we should understand this. I mean, I did think there was a little bit of Griffith protesting too much. The D.C. Circuit doesn't usually split by party. Here it did, with Griffith as the exception. And the panel decision was purely by party. The D.C. Circuit has had this long period of relative non-ideological decision-making. Are we seeing the end of it and seeing a period now in which the D.C. Circuit is divided in a more partisan fashion than it used to be?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I would maybe contest the premise a little bit that it's been sort of non-ideological going back. I mean, I think there's always been a pretty significantly different views on the court, particularly about the kinds of important issues that come to the D.C. Circuit, like presidential power. And you can think of some of the, you know, the Gitmo cases and the habeas cases where there's pretty strident dissents. So I think here, you know, to me, it's striking that there are two dissents on a mandamus issue. You know, anybody who's ever done appellate litigation knows that, you know, if you're seeking mandamus, you're probably losing.
I just want to say there's a really important exception to that rule, which is Scott and my current case, where we are asking for a writ of mandamus from the district court, actually. And I think we are going to get one. And I don't want to concede that we are losing as a result of our procedural posture.
Well, I would never say that you guys are losing in any way, but and more with the appellate courts, because the idea of mandamus is, so with the district court, I'll set aside mandamus in the district court and go with the mandamus to an appellate court. You're basically saying you need to step in and preempt the sort of normal route of appeal. And appellate courts are obviously, and for good reason, hesitant to grant that kind of relief because it means a lot more work for them. As soon as they start granting them, more people are going to ask them to step in early. And so it's a very, very hard remedy to get from an appellate court. The executive branch got it in the Cheney case, which appears throughout the Flynn opinion, and it comes up a lot in matters of executive privilege, which I talked about. But that case involved, you know, they were going to have to turn over a lot of documents. And so they went to the appellate court and then to the Supreme Court to say, you need to stop this. And so I think this ruling is a real institutionally important ruling for the D.C. Circuit and the recusal part as well, to say, you know, litigants in the government as well can't just seek mandamus and cite, sort of wave your hands at separation of powers principles and harm and get the appellate court to rule in. We have a normal course of appellate procedure. You let the district court decide, and then we will step in. And I think it is very notable and surprising, you know, if you had told someone sort of prior to reading the panel decision that mandamus would get two votes. I think most, you know, neutral observers or even non-neutral observers would have been shocked to say that they would be two votes for mandamus before the district court has even done anything. But I think the district court here has been, you know, in some ways maybe overly assertive about protecting its right. It's, if you're a nerd about who gets to represent the government and what role courts should have and prosecution, I mean, it's a fascinating case to say a judge has hired private counsel to defend the judge's ability to decide a case, and the prosecutor and the defendant are on the same side against the judge. I mean, there's all kinds of fascinating aspects here, but I think the fact that the Judge Sullivan has hired private counsel, appointed amicus, maybe rubbed some of the judges the wrong way, and maybe they thought he's being too aggressive, and that's where this, and the SG's office, that's where this recusal stuff comes from. But I think the opinion is really an institutional opinion. I think that's what Griffith is trying to say, that this is a really basic premise. Mandamus is extraordinary. Recusal is also, you know, assigning to a different judge is also extremely rare and should be used very sparingly, only in the most extreme situations, or else everybody's going to ask for it. So I think you see the majority upholding those institutional norms, and, you know, Judge Henderson and Judge Rao are willing to I think flout them and open up sort of an alternative channel of appellate review for the government, essentially, when there's these separation of powers harms. And you know, I think that would, I don't know if partisan is the right word, or if it's just sort of willing to bend over backward to help the government when they view it as any type of infringement on these separation of powers ideas.
Yeah, just to expand on that question about Judge Sullivan seeking mandamus, you know, the point that, as I recall, the majority in this en banc opinion made, and I think it's the right one, is that this is a sort of step where the judge is advocating, or I guess defending, or at least questioning a ruling on his authority to take a particular action. He actually still has not ruled on a particular motion that relates specifically to Flynn. You know, this could be as easily an effort to defend a judicial prerogative or questions of authorities that have very little to do with the merits underlying the case and the case individually. Again, it's simply a question as to whether the trial judge has the authority or should have the authority to move forward these sorts of motions. You could argue a similar basis for prejudice, procedurally very different, but even for more conventional appeals. You know, you are seeing an appeal go up by the parties. The judge perhaps hopes they're not reversed, is inclined to not be reversed by the upper court, but ultimately is here. That does, just because it happened to lose and the matter's returned to the lower court, and the lower court then has to operate on a different conception of its own power than it did before, isn't taken to be a sign that they are somehow prejudiced towards the defendant in a case. And I think the fact that this is arriving at a very similar outcome by a very much less conventional procedural sort of posture, but nonetheless a similar outcome, a ruling simply on the trial judge's authority and not substantive judgment regarding the defendant in this case, makes it a little hard to distinguish in my mind. That's part of the reason why I don't find it super credible to say that that step alone is something that really bears on a sort of prejudice towards Flynn as a defendant that's sufficient to rise to the very high standard that it normally takes to reassign a trial judge.
Yeah, I think I would say, just to echo that quickly, that the, you know, that this is really an institutional ruling about the authority of the judge and the authority of the judiciary as a whole under the rule that we're talking about to decide, you know, to answer a motion and to issue an opinion. And it has, I think it's gotten tied up in all of the Flynn stuff. But this opinion and judge's actions, I think, are really about defending the role of judges in these types of cases, as opposed to, you know, making General Flynn go to jail or something like that.
All right. So we kind of know what happens next in the McGann case, which is it presumably goes en banc again. But what happens next in the Flynn case is a little bit opaque, right? So it goes now back to Judge Sullivan, who gets to decide this motion and presumably gets to do a little bit of at least interrogation and maybe fact-finding along the way. If you were Judge Sullivan, do you take this as a directive, basically, you know, make whatever noise you need to make, but then dismiss the thing? Or do you take it as more of a, hey, the district court is entitled to have the district court's process, and we'll review whatever happens afterwards if we're asked to? If you're Judge Sullivan, how do you read this opinion? Jonathan, wrap us up.
I think he will dismiss the case. I think he will read it as, perform your task of investigating and satisfying yourself that the requirements are met. But he's got to know, there's several hints in the opinion as well, that if he denies the motion, it will be another mandamus or perhaps a straight appeal under the collateral order doctrine. And there, then some of these separation of powers principles are full center. And so I think he reads it as, you know, you have the space to do what you need to do. But I also think he will ultimately dismiss it after he does that. I don't know, Scott, maybe you have a different view of that.
I think that's probably right. It is very hard to imagine a universe where this prosecution is kind of compelled to go forward, or they're not allowed to dismiss this action when the Justice Department is saying, we don't want to do it, we don't think there's enough evidence. But that said, to go forward with this sort of exceptional situation is really exceptional in of itself. And it doesn't seem unreasonable for the judge to say, okay, I want to look into why this position is being advanced by the Justice Department and subject it to real scrutiny. And there is some case law that allows some wiggle room for denying these sorts of motions in certain very exceptional circumstances. But it's not 100% clear that'll be met here. There are two other factors that are in play, though, in my mind. One is the fact that, again, this was a motion to dismiss with prejudice, meaning that there's not opportunities to go back and retry it. I am not a criminal law expert. And so I'm not confident to say the extent to which there is space to depart from that particular outcome. But the one thing I would say is that strikes me as the most problematic part, just from a sort of outcomes and process perspective, because essentially the judge is being asked to do something in an environment that seems like a decision was driven in part by partisan motivations, or at least arguably will be perceived that way by a lot of people, and reaching a permanent outcome that will foreclose possible prosecution that a future presidential administration, a future Justice Department may think is warranted and want to pursue. And in fact, this Justice Department did until recently, before it reversed its opinion. So perhaps there's some space by which the judge might be able to reach a different conclusion on that point. Alternatively, there's an election coming in the relatively near future. And there may be enough basis. Part of the logic here might be to say, all right, well, let's see if there is, in fact, enough here. And if not, there's a possibility of running out the clock. I think certainly if you were to have a kind of opposed party here, which we don't really at the moment, other than the amicus, maybe they would try and do that strategy and say, well, the future administration, if it's a Biden administration, may not feel the same way here. That's a really problematic thing for the trial judge to do. I wouldn't endorse that. I don't think many people would endorse that. And I don't really think that's what Judge Sullivan is doing, especially because the, you know, 5 months we have, 6 months we have before a Biden administration would actually sit in January is a long time to drag this out for a practical matter, and it would look weird for them to do it and probably inappropriate. But nonetheless, that is a factor that kind of hovers in the background of this whole case, and I think does inevitably inform certainly how people perceive the case and probably how Judge Sullivan thinks about and approaches it as well.
I agree with that. I think if you were Judge Sullivan, the temptation to drag this into the period in which the president would actually have to use the pardon power to resolve it would be substantial. He has been jerked around by both the government and by General Flynn over a long period of time. And he clearly wants to use this process to shed some light on what happened. And I think the likelihood of him trying to drag it out into a Biden administration is vanishingly small, and I agree would be very improper. On the other hand, if it just so happened that the process of resolving it took long enough that the president turned into a lame duck and was outgoing and had to use his pardon power to make sure that General Flynn's conviction did not stand, that might only take a month and a half or 2 months at this point. And that's actually plausibly consistent with the time frame in which the motions and hearings that he's ordered might take anyway. So I think, you know, one question is, does this spill over into the period after the election, but before the inauguration? We are going to leave it there. Scott Anderson, Jonathan Schaub, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. It's Lawfare's birthday. It's our 10th birthday, so send a happy birthday tweet to the Lawfare Podcast. Share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, upvote us on Reddit, and for the love of God, make TikTok videos about Lawfare. You can get Lawfare merch, and you know you want it, at thelawfarestore.com. You can get Lawfare rocks glasses. You can get all kinds of stuff, pens, notebooks, everything you need. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the one and only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.